Welcome back here to our studios, Dr. Robert Bojack. He's a pediatrician, and he now every other month is here on the program. It's always on Thursday, just like before, and we wanted to continue to have him here to give folks the chance to ask questions about children's health. So that's the deal. Anything that you could think of that you could discuss with a pediatrician, you give us a call, and I know that he will take his best shot at answering that question. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we will pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455 at any point here. If you have questions, you can give us a call. Welcome back.
It's good to be here.
We're glad to have you here. Well, there's something I know that you would be interested in talking a little bit about here to start us off. In the news recently, and people may have heard about this, there is now a new vaccine that has been approved to protect people against the human papilloma virus. And this is the virus that, among other things, causes genital warts. And it's all been implicated in some forms of cervical cancer. Yes. Not all, but some. So the idea is that if you can give the vaccine, and because the virus is sexually transmitted, the idea is you have to give it before people start to become sexually active. And apparently we're not looking at giving this to boys.
No.
So the thing is, we're saying, all right, we're going to decide at some point before girls become sexually active, and here we get into a big argument, at some point before they become sexually active, we're going to give them this vaccine. And of course, it's not going to do any good if we wait till after. So it's got to be before. And I think now the recommendation has been made is that, and I'm not sure about what age we're talking about.
11.
Okay. So the recommendation now is that all girls at age 11 get this shot. And actually, I think it's a series of shots.
It's three, yeah.
Now, I know we've talked a lot about vaccines in the past, and you've pretty much said go vaccine. It's a good thing. Now, this one, though, you say maybe you're not quite sure.
I have trouble with this one because cancer of the cervix apparently has been decreasing over the years. And that's probably thanks to pap smears and the annual exam of women. I think the annual exam, vaccine won't make that unnecessary. And I think the other thing to say that the woman's genital tract contains a cervix and that's all we care about is obviously not true. We care about other things too. So this will not replace the annual exam and pap smear. I guess the other thing is how effective it's going to be. Well, you know what? We've used other vaccines that we don't know about their long-term efficacy either. But the thing, I guess the way I have concern is we're talking about $300 per series per girl times 2 million. There's about 2 million girls born per year. So that's $600. If my calculations are right, we're spending $600 million to prevent 10,000 cases of cervical, approximately 10,000 cases of cervical cancer a year. Is that money well spent? Or $600 million? Plus, that's an underestimate because we also have all these other gals times 20 years to play catch up. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about billions of dollars to do it. And it's hard to say how much is a human life worth, but how much is a human life worth, and are we better off spending this money, designating it for other areas, since we seem to have early diagnostic potential for cancer of the cervix, and apparently, if found early, it's like most cancers, it's quite treatable. And I think I think Suzanne Troop, Dr. Troupin would disagree with this, but
I think she would.
And I think what I'm really saying is in this country, we need somebody other than for-profit corporations to decide on our health care policy. And I think that's basically what we need. We need a healthcare policy system in this country other than one driven by Merck or Pfizer or whoever.
Has the American Academy of Pediatrics now taken a formal position on this?
I looked on the web yesterday, and the best I could find out is the American Academy of Pediatrics has not taken a formal position. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecology has not taken a formal position yet. It may be coming because I think this vaccine has only been approved for
maybe
a couple of weeks
yeah. or it may have been longer than that. I'm kind of thinking that it was in – this happened in June, but yes, it's not been very long. Well, Susanna's going to be here on Monday.
Okay.
We'll get her take on it and see what she says about that very thing. Because, I mean, certainly you're right. There are other – this won't do anything about ovarian cancer, about other forms of cancer. There's also no guarantee that if you have received this vaccine, you could still get cervical cancer.
I think this is a very expensive vaccine that we're saying, gee, maybe 30 years from now, we're going to see a big decrease in cervical cancer, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure that's – maybe it's true, maybe it's not. It's something we just have to do and find out, but, boy, it's very expensive doing it.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a caller here. We have certainly time for plenty of other things. If you want to talk about this or anything else that has to do with children's health, that is what we are doing here this morning. Every other month, we do this program with Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician and has been here on the show for a long time doing this very program. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the answer is to this question about whether, you know, how widespread the vaccine should be, but a couple of comments or thoughts or questions. One is I questioned Dr. Tupin about whether these viruses were solely sexually transmitted, and she said no. That you can get them in other ways. So that's one thing that people should be aware of. I think some people think, many of us think that our parents don't have sex and our kids aren't going to have sex.
Yes. And we, you know what, we know this. Yeah.
So that's one thing. Another thing is that a lot of people don't actually get annual exams. For whatever reason, either lack of insurance or because they don't get around to it, you know, life gets complicated. I mean, this has happened to me. You can get kind of feel like lightning isn't going to hit you. And then, especially if you've only had one partner, you may think that this might not happen to you. Those are statements, but one of my questions is one of the treatments for, cervical cancer beginnings, the things that are leading up, the stages leading up to cervical cancer is cervical conization, where they take out a cone-shaped piece of the cervix. And I'm wondering whether if that happens to someone before she finishes childbearing, whether it affects her ability to have a vaginal birth safely.
You know, this may be a better question to save for next Monday when Dr. Troopin's here, but my understanding is I don't think it does.
Okay.
You know, and I think that's the other weird thing. That's the other unique thing about this vaccine is we're giving the job to pediatricians to prevent a disease that is not ours. You know, I've never seen a case of cervical cancer in the pediatric age group. And I think the other thing you brought up, yes, the annual exam is very important. With this vaccine, will women say, you know what, I've had the vaccine. The annual exam is not the high point of my year. It's not a thing I look forward to, but I've had the vaccine, so I'm safe from cervical cancer, so I won't get I won't have the annual exam.
Yep, there's lots of complications here in the human psychology bit. But another thing to think about is that oftentimes women do not plan to have their first intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
Given the number of women who are girls who are abused by older men mm-hmm. or talked into having sex by older men. I mean, most teenage pregnancies, the male is considerably older. If people are thinking my daughter isn't going to be having sex because of whatever reasons, the base rate shows otherwise. So complications. It is a complicated thing, but it's we should be thinking about lots of different things going on here. Thanks very much for your.
You're
insight.
Welcome.
Thanks for the call.
Bye. Yeah, should we immunize men, since they spread the? Yeah, since we call it a sexually transmitted disease and they spread it to women, but that makes it a whole lot worse, doesn't it, economically. Well,
we're going to double the cost, yeah. I guess, roughly speaking. And I think that the issue is that it has not yet been tested on men, but I kind of think the idea is that eventually you will test the vaccine on men, and that if it's found to be safe and effective, then at some point, I think we should expect there also will be a recommendation that boys get it too. So it's not, even though, one might make the argument that because it's the women who get cervical cancer, they're the ones that should have the vaccine. If men are involved in spreading it, well, then maybe we should say everybody should get the vaccine. Well, we talked about the fact that one of the issues with this vaccine is that it's very expensive.
Yes.
For the series of shots, we're looking at over $300. And that's not an inconsequential amount of money when you're thinking about how many people would get it. Is this just a case that, well, it's early days on the vaccine, it's just become available. If we get to the point where we're making more of it and we can, there's some sort of cost reduction attached to the volume, that it's not, is it always going to be $360, or is it some point where it's maybe going to be only $100 or something like that? And I don't know.
I don't know either. I hope so, but I expect it'll be $300 till the patent goes off.
I see. So, yeah, it brings us back to the original point about pharmaceutical companies and their interest. Yeah. Okay. Well, when Suzanne is here, Dr. Suzanne Troopin, she will be here on Monday at 11 o'clock hour. So, and I know this is something that she and I have talked about sort of on and off over time, and we'll put some of those same questions.
I'll pop in. We'll have a debate.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that she would say that the concerns over balancing the costs with what you think the benefits are, that's a certainly legitimate discussion. I think any time when you talk about healthcare and the cost of healthcare, you've got to ask the same question. What are you getting for the amount of money that you're putting in? And at this point, maybe it's not an easy thing to answer. All right. Well, we have somebody here on a cell phone. They're on our line number one. We'll talk with them. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You posed that the price would more likely than not or maybe go down. I have a friend who's a pharmacist, and she told me of a cancer treatment that just because they could, because they were the only drug company who had it, they doubled the price.
Oops.
So, you can't assume it's going to go down just because they have the patent. They doubled it from like $50,000 to $100,000.
Wow.
That's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Well,
I have no response, but I accept that. I think, let's just say I don't look for the price to go down as long as the patent's. Hopefully it won't go up.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Robert Bojek. He's a pediatrician and clinical assistant professor at University of Illinois. And every other month he's here to do this program. We talk about children's health, and we have been doing this for a long time. If you want to ask him a question, it needn't be on this issue that we just started out talking about here. It can be anything that has to do with kids' health, behavior, development, illness, wellness, all of that kind of stuff. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, and line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There's an article about this vaccine in the July issue of the Public Eye, which is put out by our local independent media center. It's written by Dr. Troopin. I just wanted to point out that Dr. Troopin is paid to do research by Merck, so that's something to consider. Also, I wanted to ask a question about BMIs in small children, because my older son had his 3-month appointment or 3-year appointment a couple of months ago, and his doctor said he was just over the limit for a good BMI for a 3-year-old. And when I look at him, I see his ribs. He looks fine to me, but I'm just wondering. That's something that we should be concerned about.
Yes. I think yes. And there was a recent study where they asked, an independent observer looked at this kid, or they did BMIs or whatever, and said, this kid is overweight, obese, whatever. And they asked the parents what they thought. And they showed pictures, silhouette pictures of kids, and the parents always underestimated the child's weight or their appearance. They denied the overweightness, if you will. So I think if the BMI is elevated, presuming it was calculated right, and, you know, you get this off a chart, so let's presume it was calculated. Yeah, if the height and weight measurements were right, the BMI is right, so yes, you should be concerned. And
okay.
Which means, yeah, watch the soft drinks, watch the snacks and the high-calorie foods.
Yeah, he doesn't really get any of those, so I'm not... sure what to cut out, but we'll take a look at it. Thank you.
And the other choice besides cutting anything out is increasing the activity level.
Oh, that's true. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Right,
thank you.
Bye-bye.
And just for people who are not sure, we're talking about this, the BMI, that's the body mass index, and it's a number that you arrive at by taking a certain kind of calculation. Yeah. I don't know what the formula is, but basically it's calculation that involves the weight of the individual and their height.
Right.
And you put those two together and you crunch the numbers and then you get a number.
Yes.
And so that's used to make some general sort of recommendations of, is this person in the what we consider to be the optimum weight? Are they below it? Are they above it? And particular concerns are when people are above what's there supposed to be their sort of what's considered to be the range that's considered to be healthy, sort of in the middle. And I guess people can have problems if they're severely underweight, but certainly,
yes.
You know, people can have problems if they're severely over.
And in the United States, and I think the developed world, underweight is
much of a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more the other problem. And, of course, that contributes to a lot of problems like heart disease and
diabetes
and other sorts of things. And that has become, and this is also something we've talked about a lot, is becoming an increasing concern in children, diabetes. As we're starting to see a lot more kids that are either pre-diabetic, that we know are headed that way if nothing happens, or that we're seeing a lot more kids who have the type 2 diabetes that you generally didn't see in children and adolescents before.
Yeah, it didn't exist. And, yeah, it's – I don't know what to do with type 2 diabetes because it's really sort of not adult type 2. It's sort of like a 1B or something like that. It likes people of color. It likes African Americans. It likes Hispanics. And I don't think it's well understood why it likes those.
No. And I think also Native Americans are prone as well. And that it seems to have some kind of genetic connection, but it's not something that's really understood at all.
But it does seem to respond nicely to weight loss. These people can come off insulin, their risk of, it can respond very nicely to weight loss.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, whatever questions people have has to do with children's health, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Maybe also it'd be good to remind people that when we get to this time of the year here, now it's the month of July, and on the average, we have our hottest temperatures in July. And just recently, because of high temperatures and high humidity, we've had days when the heat index was up in the upper 90s, or I think we've had a couple of days this week that it's been at 100 or over. So you want to be concerned with your kids and their activities outside so that they don't end up with getting heat stroke. Well, just sort of what's the general kind of recommendations when it gets like this?
I think Ed has covered that well. You know, when it's when it's hot, don't go outside. And we've talked about how important reading is. School's out. Take this opportunity to read to your child in the air conditioning or the shade. Yeah. And probably in the air conditioning.
Yeah.
And remember, I don't know, you don't have a veterinarian on usually, but same rules apply to your dog. And you know what? Kids are in worse shape to tolerate heat than adults are because they have less surface area. And they don't perspire as well. They don't lose heat as well and they absorb it better. And it's just, it's more important for, well, you know what? When it's this hot, it's not good for anybody.
Yeah. So the advice is, try and restrict your outdoor activity and make sure that everybody keeps well hydrated.
Yes.
And probably the best way to do that is just with water.
Water. Yeah. Gatorade would like you to drink their product, but tap water's, at least in Champaign-Urbana, is fine.
Yeah, okay. It won't be probably too long before school sports programs start going again, and they'll be having the kids outside, working outside. Any particular concerns there?
No. Yes and no. It's sort of out of your control, but make sure, you know, when you drop your child off, or give them the keys to the car. But anyway, make sure that there is that the coach has plenty of water breaks for him, water or fluid breaks. If the school wants to pay for Gatorade or Gatorade supplying it, that's fine with me. But it's the water in there that I'm after, and make sure that they have water breaks, especially since they usually start with double sessions in the hottest time of the year, and they need water breaks.
Okay. Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I am calling up with a follow-up question actually related to the last question about the mother who called in with the son who had the hot BMI.
Mm-hmm.
My son is 4 years old, and I had the same thing happen at his annual appointment this year that the doctor looked on the chart. And I had a couple questions then to follow up on this. Essentially, one thing is that my son is in the 90th percentile on his height.
Okay.
95th on weight. So he's a little bit higher on the weight, 95th on weight, 90th on height.
Yeah.
And one of my questions is, one of the things that we did, this annual appointment was in May. It follows up a month of a lot of birthdays in our family.
Okay.
So there was absolutely a lot of cake eaten that month before. Now, it's summer. He's out playing every day, probably at least an hour. You know, we're eating lots of fruit and vegetables like we usually do, and he's looks skinny again.
Okay.
To me. So what I'm wondering is, are these charts available online? Could we go back to the doctor and check it? Because I think his weight fluctuates a little bit, and if we've had a month of inactivity or extra sweets because of holidays, which I think is happening right before this.
It could do it, sure. You know, and I guess
that sensitive, how big a difference is there? You know, I mean, it's a real sensitive measure here.
Yeah, because I forget the formula either, but you square something.
Well,
you
know, I know that.
It's not the same as adults. I know it's not height divided by weight or weight divided by height.
No, it's the same formula.
Oh, because, okay.
Yeah, it's the same formula at whatever age. But I think maybe the important thing is, okay, where was your child's BMI? You know, how high, how far off the scale was he?
Yeah, no,
if he was just,
If
he was just over, I'd say, you know what, worry about it, or be concerned about it. Don't be alarmed about it, but be concerned about it and, you know, kind of review his activity level, review what he eats, and make changes you need to that way. And you could very well be right that he had May was a big party month, a lot of, high-calorie, dense food, and he put on a little weight.
Oh, yeah. He looked a little heavier to us.
And maybe the weather was bad that month, so he didn't get as much exercise as he used to, or he was still in school or whatever. And, if he shed a little weight and he was just on the borderline, I wouldn't even go back to the doctor. I wouldn't even look up the new number. You'd just say, you know what, his pants are a little looser. I've plopped him on the scale. His weight's down a little bit, and his BMI was just borderline. I'm going to say, you know what? Fine. It's probably not borderline anymore. It's probably in the normal range.
Okay. Because I think what I'm observing is that the kids are like we are as adults. Their weight fluctuates a little bit over the year relative to their height.
Absolutely.
We're a little less active in the winter because it's hard to be outside.
Yeah.
We're trying to do stuff inside, but there's only so much we can do. Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to follow up on that because I'm sure that mom was thinking the same thing. He's outside now.
Yeah. And I think the other thing about kids is, do kids grow at a regular rate? Do they put on 2 millimeters per day? No, we know that they don't. They spend some time not growing, and then they have their growth spurts.
Right.
And if the weight spurt precedes the growth spurt, there's going to be a problem there.
My kids do, and he has spurted since that appointment.
Yeah. And as long as the two match up, eventually, he's in good shape.
Okay. So not something we necessarily need to go back to the doctor for in the middle of the year as long as we're observing this kind of thing.
No. You know what? This is not a blood urea nitrogen where we're measuring kidney function.
Yeah.
To where it's going to stay. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, well, bye-bye. Thanks for the call. And just to, also to sort of pick up on one of the things that, the caller mentioned, I know if you have internet access, there are a number of places on the web where they will calculate the BMI for you. I know, for example, I just put into my web browser BMI, and one of the hits I got here was a site at the Centers for Disease Control. And here they have the calculator, and I think that basically all you got to do is here put in your height and your weight and click on calculate, and it will tell you what it is. And I think that there are a number of places on the web that will do that for you. And then you can hopefully also that we'll have some information here that will help you figure out what that number means and whether there's some reason for you to be concerned or not.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if he's at the 95th percentile for weight and the 95th percentile for height, the BMI still is accurate. It's still, the norms have allowed for the big kids and the petite kids and that sort of thing. So it's, the BMI is still the BMI.
Well, about midway through this hour of Focus 580 with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's with us every other month. We talk about children's health, and questions are welcome. I would like to mention also that we're keeping an eye on the weather this morning. We have had some pretty good thunderstorms here roll through our coverage area, and there continues to be a severe thunderstorm watch that is in effect and will be in effect for about another half an hour until 11 o'clock this morning. In our severe weather coverage area, these counties are included: Champaign, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, Piatt, Shelby, and Vermilion. And that is a severe thunderstorm watch, and that will be in effect until 11. And, of course, that means a watch means that conditions are favorable for storms in and around the watch area. So you should keep an eye out for heavy weather. Also, there is a heat advisory in effect for parts of central and southern Illinois, including Sangamon and Christian counties. And there is an excessive heat warning in effect for southwestern Illinois, and that's until 7 o'clock tonight. So, again, if you're going to be doing stuff outside, you want to keep that in mind. Maybe if you can restrict your outdoor activity, that's good. If you really have to be out there, one thing you really need to keep in mind is you keep yourself well hydrated, and so keep drinking water.
But this weekend is supposed to be pleasant. So the weeds can be pulled out this weekend.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just put it off to, you don't need to be doing that stuff out there today.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk with another listener, someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple of questions on the, we had our 2-year checkup, and the doctor said he doesn't have to have the whole milk anymore, that in fact skim would be fine, 2% would be fine. And so I know that's all about the, I guess the obesity stuff that they want to deal with. But, you know, he doesn't drink as much milk anymore either.
That's right.
Kind of. He scaled that back. So is it really critical at this point that we switch over? Because his dad really likes the whole milk, too.
You know what? I think I worry about dad drinking whole milk more than I worry about your 2-year-old drinking whole milk. Yes and no. If they're both normal weight, the concern is the fat intake.
Okay.
So if they're both normal weight and dad really likes whole milk, but he doesn't eat French fries and and that sort of stuff. You say, you know what? It's probably okay.
Okay. But, I mean, it's not going to hurt him. It's just all that, it's just really the concern with the overweight population.
Yeah, fat intake and obesity and to a certain extent cholesterol levels and that sort of thing from the fat intake.
Yeah, so that's the real concern. Well, the other question I have is with regard to diaper rashes.
Okay.
Are there certain foods that tend to trigger rashes more than others? Or, I mean, I don't know if there's any studies that have been done, but, you know, some days he'll be fine for a long time, then all of a sudden, boom, there's a rash, and it'll take us days to get it cleared up, and it gets bad to where it's even scarring, and it can happen within an hour. Like, he'll have nothing. And, you know, before lunch and then after his nap, boom, there it is.
He's got ulcerations, you know, I think if kids tend to binge on something, you know, when oranges come into season or something like that, I'm going to eat a whole lot of oranges or I'm going to drink a lot of lemonade and I'm going to get a lot of acidy food and my stool's going to get acid and my urine's going to get acid and my skin's going to get irritated.
Okay, so it's really acidic kinds of foods that tend to do it?
Yeah, you know, well, I probably shouldn't say that either because I've not seen any studies. But, yeah, I think some chemicals are more irritating than others.
Okay, and then treatments, we do the basic, you know, the stuff that's over the counter.
That's right.
And that's, someone told me, there was a recipe, somebody said something like Benadryl with, I can't remember if it was petroleum jelly or something like that.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
No. Yeah, no? But it sounds like a recipe somebody come up with. Yeah, my favorite product used to be zinc oxide.
Okay, so just because it's got the zinc in it.
Yeah, well, yeah, the zinc probably helps skin heal up. But I think my favorite part about zinc oxide is it was thick.
Okay.
And it stuck.
And that's amazing.
And it was a barrier, and it protected the skin, yeah.
Okay, so it's the barrier to form that, so it doesn't irritate it any further.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think the other thing we do about diaper rashes that's wrong is we clean them. We take an SOS pad, and we clean them. Well, not quite that, but I think, yeah, we are super vigorous about cleaning, and I think as the skin begins to heal, we rub it off with a cloth, with whatever, but it's still somewhat abrasive. And so I think the name of the game with diaper rash is gentle cleaning,
okay,
frequent changing, and perhaps a barrier of zinc oxide, something that provides a artificial skin, if you will, a coating.
Okay. Okay. Well, hopefully toilet training's next on our list. We won't have to worry.
That's
about
the ultimate cure for diaper rash. Is get him out of diapers.
All right, thank you.
But he is a boy, so
yeah, I know. Everyone says that, but he's starting to, you know, get interested and you know, likes to kind of, you know, look and see how the whole toilet thing works, and he's tried a couple of times just to sit on it, not to do anything. But we were told, don't push it. Just let him kind of, you know, lead the way a little, and you can help them. Yeah. But
and let me also add that most boys train when all girls train. You know, so it's right about age two. But if there's a stinker in the bunch, somebody who's resistant, it's going to be a boy.
Okay. Right. So he's okay at this point then to just kind of start leading him a little bit more?
Oh, sure. Oh. Yeah, you know, I'd certainly encourage it.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe when you go to the bathroom, he can sit on his potty and, yeah, just to kind of get the wheels turning a bit.
Well, that brings up a question, whether or not to use the potty, the little porter, or I don't know, what do you call them, the little ones, or do you put one of those seat things, or does it matter?
It may not matter, but I think in general people say a separate potty because they feel more secure.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember my kids when they were toilet training, we had the seat on the toilet, and you know there they were clinging for dear life.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So because a friend of ours gave us one of their old ones.
Yeah.
And so it seemed to be pretty clean and good.
And I think moms do a better job of toilet training because boys have to learn to urinate by sitting. They tend to learn to urinate by sitting down.
Instead of standing up.
Okay. And because if they try and stand up, toilet's too high, and, yeah, it gets kind of messy.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Okay. All right. Well, good. Good advice. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Let's go on to line number two, and I believe this is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
The funny thing about the toilet training is, as a guy gets older, he gets kind of messy, too.
Jeez.
And should learn how to sit down.
You know what?
I think any opportunity to sit down is a good thing myself.
Well, you know, and you're quite right. You know, as our prostates get bigger, the urine stream, it diverts, and we tend to dribble, and
And stuff. But try running without a diaper to avoid the diaper rash.
That's right.
It works, too.
That's right.
But the comment about milk, with our milk being now generated on highly commercial farms, there's probably too much estrogen in it to really want to have any kid or adult use a lot of it. I mean, chesty guys look like hell, but chesty gals that aren't milking aren't worth a darn either.
I guess I don't have a response to that. Yeah, there's a lot of talk about estrogen, and there's talk about phytoestrogen, the estrogen we get from plants, and how important is it, or how significant is it in breast cancer, uterine cancer, that sort of thing, mainly the female cancers again, although men die of breast cancer too.
Oh, yes, honest.
Yeah.
Guys get mastectomies.
Yes.
Another question I've questioned all my life that, for example, on the Indian continent, is that with viruses having a very short life change, are vaccines, especially for viral things, kind of treating the past disease that is probably or possibly out of phase and it really doesn't affect the newly developed virus that's come? And in giving ourselves, our young people especially, the immunization that comes from shots, allowing the body to develop a laziness toward infecting it, toward affecting the new form of a virus or bacteria that's going to attack anyway.
Yeah,
and I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay. The answer to that question is yes. You're right and you're wrong. Some viruses, like the influenza virus, we've talked about many times on this program. Yeah, last year's vaccine probably isn't worth anything next year. But like a lot of our other viral vaccines, polio, I think the types of polio have been stable over the years. So some viruses tend to mutate and some viruses tend not to. And I think that's what makes the HIV/AIDS virus so difficult to make a vaccine against, because it mutates very fast. So some viruses, yes, some viruses, no. Bacteria, they tend to exchange information with each other. You know, this antibiotic, you know, here's the way to get around to be resistant to it, and here I'll send you a plasmid and we'll become resistant to it. I think the other thing that's sort of interesting is during the Civil War, apparently more men died of disease, more soldiers died of disease than they died of wounds, and part of the answer to that is they were taking these guys off the farm. And so they were living in a low population density area, and diseases didn't tend to get in there. And then you put them in a camp of 30,000 or 6,000, or it doesn't matter, but you really put them in a dense population, and they weren't immune to any of this stuff. And so, a lot of them got sick and died in camps during the war. Also, it's interesting, I think the pandemic of 18. May have been American.
Who think that it started in a military encampment
in New Mexico or something. Yeah,
and then because the soldiers were then sent to Europe to fight in World War I, it sent it over there, and then it got going over there, and then it came back. It passed back and forth. But I think that you're right. People think it started in Kansas or something like that.
And it may have ended World War I, or may have been. Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Other questions are certainly welcome. We have about 15 minutes left. Dr. Robert Bocek is with us. He's a pediatrician. He's here every other month on a Thursday. We talk about children's health. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Line 3 is next. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about, I've got a grandson that's about 6 years old. And he's had blood in his bowel movements, and he's had a colonoscopy, and he's had polyps, and he's had several polyps removed. And I'm kind of concerned about this. And I said, is this rare, or is it something to be concerned about, or any opinions?
Yes, that is unusual. It exists. It is unusual. Most often in kids, we'll have blood in the stool and they have a single polyp that they usually shed and pass and everything's well. But if he's having, needing colonoscopies, having multiple polyps, that is rare. It exists. I've heard of it. It is rare. And yeah, he needs to have continued follow-up and continued regular colonoscopies to make sure that these polyps behave themselves.
Oh, boy. Doesn't sound too good. Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. Something that someone just mentioned to me in passing and suggested that I might ask you about. So one of my colleagues here said they were just recently reading a magazine article, and it was about staph germs, staphylococcus, okay, that were resistant to treatment. So that sounded like it was something really particularly to be concerned about. And also it said some basic things about the fact that staph, it's all around us,
yeah,
you know. So it's the kind of thing that you cannot completely avoid getting in contact with. And are there some general sorts of guidelines that you can suggest and have been suggested to people to make sure, you know, minimize whatever chance of exposure that you have to staph?
No, because staph, you know, staph is everywhere. And basically staph is our friend because we like a good flora. You know, we like a mixed flora on our skin, and the mixed flora will keep some of the pathogens away because some of the pathogens don't. Some other bugs apparently don't get along with staph very well, so they won't live on us. The problem is antibiotic use again. Used to be, well, even when I was in training, and this was, three or four decades ago, staph was beginning to get to be a problem. And the more you used antibiotics, as I talked about before, these germs share information. This is the way you get around this antibiotic. And so we developed methicillin-resistant staph. And the more antibiotics we used, and the staph got brighter and brighter, and now you've got staph that are resistant to about everything. And at first it was a hospital, in-hospital problem, an intensive care unit problem. And now it seems that this smart staph or this antibiotic-resistant staph has gotten out into the general population. But it's still something I not stay – we aren't seeing epidemics. You know, it's an increased problem what it used to be, but it's not a big deal. It's kind of like necrotizing fasciitis, the flesh-eating bacteria. You know, boy, is that a neat story.
Sounds really bad.
Is that a neat story? I have never seen it. I have never talked to a physician who's seen one. It exists. It's real, but it's rare.
Yeah. The other thing that this person mentioned to me that also was mentioned in this particular article, although it sounds like not explained very well, had to do with wound cleaning.
Yeah.
Where that recommended that if you do have a scrape, a cut, something like that, that is something that you should do. But that it recommended the basic way to do it was soap and water. And particularly what they said, and this sort of confused me, and it didn't explain really why, they said don't use hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah. Hydrogen peroxide apparently will damage the tissue. So now you've, yeah.
So you're just making it worse.
You're making it worse. Soap and water and an intact immune system. And that's why our body makes antibodies and it makes white cells and it makes opsins and all kinds of stuff. And for the most part, we're designed for the nicks and scrapes and the bad parts of daily living. It just, and you know what? There are bad critters out there. And you don't want them, and the chances are you're not going to get them because they're rare.
So clean with soap and water.
Clean with soap and water.
And you probably wouldn't hurt to put a Band-Aid on it or something to cover it.
Band-Aid, I think, is still in because the fibroblasts, the tissue healing cells, swim. So we want to keep, we want to keep the wound
sort of moist.
Moist.
Okay.
Not wet, not soggy, but a Band-Aid over it will keep it moist enough.
And, okay, so now what do you think there for the variety of products that are sold sold as things that will promote healing, various kinds of, you know, cream salves, something that comes in a tube, something that some people would say, in addition to doing these other things, they would say, well, maybe I will do that. Is that going to do anything for you?
Probably. Their advertising says it does, but I think the answer is keep it clean with soap and water. Or if you don't have soap, water alone, and cover it. and probably these over-the-counter products in general are not necessary at all.
Okay.
Keep it clean and cover it.
And I think the other thing, and maybe it's probably a good bit of general advice, particularly at this time of year, people are outside, they're doing yard work, they're digging the dirt. Probably also a good thing to wear gloves. That will limit your chances of being exposed to things like tetanus, for example, or, you know, anything else. Probably don't want to, if you come up against something, you don't want to damage your skin, get a break in your skin, and then be down digging around in the dirt.
And make sure your tetanus immunization is updated.
Yeah.
That one I will not hesitate. I will not. I have no hesitation about recommending
to go
that
with tetanus. And that's every 10 years? Okay.
For adults, yes.
And when is it now? We're also talking about, and I'm sure we talked about this, actually now we're recommending for adults that they're going to put pertussis back in. So it will be, DPT now for adults just the way we give it to children.
And again, it's an acellular pertussis vaccine. Yeah, the reason we didn't give pertussis to adults or to anybody after age 7 is the reaction rate was very high and very uncomfortable. It wasn't deadly or anything like that, but it was just very uncomfortable. And now with the acellular pertussis vaccine, the reactions are milder. And yeah, as I was churning through the internet looking at some of the stuff I was going to talk about today, I found that, that the acellular pertussis vaccine, along with the diphtheria tetanus, is recommended for adults, and I support it. And why do I support it? Twofold. Is pertussis a problem in adults? Pertussis is sort of a long-term inconvenience in adults. It's a cough for 6 weeks. Pertussis can be deadly, especially for the under 1 year of age. So with this vaccine, we've eliminated the inconvenience to adults, and may we save some children's lives under age 1.
Yeah, the issue is that you don't want adults. Adults can get it. It may be unhappy, but that's pretty much it. But you don't want them giving it to the kids that could have real serious consequences from it. How come that took a long time to get clued into the fact that pertussis was still out there, that adults got it, and that they could be a reservoir for it, and that was we wanted to cut off that avenue of transmission. And it seems like it's taken us a while to figure that one out.
Yeah, I think it took a while. I can't remember when the acellular pertussis vaccine came out in kids, maybe 10 years ago. And then it's, you know, do we do it to adults, and will adults tolerate it? Because we know that the older children, adults don't tolerate the pertussis vaccine. And I suppose maybe cost factored in here. Is this bang for our buck? Mm-hmm. I think this one I have no hesitation about supporting.
Right. We have maybe a minute or a couple minutes left here. Is there anything in particular that we have not talked about that you want to talk about?
No. Sign up for your school. Get your school physical signed up for. Get your athletic physical signed up for, because the pediatricians, family practitioners are going to be overwhelmed with that pretty soon. And you may not get in, and I think the schools are getting tough about it. If you don't have proof of physical exam and immunizations, your child may not start school when the rest of the children do.
Yeah, okay. And here, let's do one more that has to do with sort of some of the same issues with older kids. And again, this is one of those things we have talked about before, meningitis vaccine for kids who are going to college and are going to be living in dorms. Yeah. Now, are we not to the point where we're saying yes?
Yes.
Parents, take your kids in and get them the shot.
Yes. Yeah, but you know what? I've rethought this one too a little bit. You know, yes, do it. But again, I think we need a generalized healthcare policy, because you say, you know what? I think there's 1,500 deaths from this disease a year. How much are we going to spend on the vaccine? How much is the life worth? And that gets into ethical problems, and we're late in the program, so let's not go there anymore.
Yeah.
But the answer is yes.
It's one of those things that you do see in situations where people are living in very close quarters.
Yes.
So that's why it's particularly of concern with kids who are living in dormitories and not generally all college students, really, but particularly those who are crammed into a small space. So, I mean, given that, is there much in the way that you could tell them, you know, tell your kid,
you know what,
in terms of
I have
prevention?
No doubt. I do the vaccine.
Okay.
I do the vaccine.
Do it.
Do the vaccine. I think, again, this doesn't fall in, because this is a one-time thing. It's a relatively inexpensive vaccine, and I have no hesitation about recommending this vaccine. And the vaccine we've had in the last few years is much better than the old vaccine, much more effective than the old vaccine we had. Okay. So, yeah, do it.
Okay. Anything else that was sort of related to back to school? Because I know that it's not going to be that long here before we're really into back to school mode.
And the year-round kids will be starting sooner than the other kids.
Yeah.
I think it's time to prepare. So get your physicals done. Check the book list. Check the equipment list. And make sure your child's prepared for school.
Yeah.
And start reading. If you've taken a summer off from reading and your child's taken a summer off from reading, it's a good thing not to take time off from. Yeah. So keep reading.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else that just sort of happens to be on your mind?
No. What? How much time do we have?
Oh, I don't know. We've got about a minute here.
Okay. No. You know what? I think, again, we need to plan ahead. We need to plan ahead as individuals. I think we need to do better planning on the national level about healthcare and making sure that our healthcare dollars, since they are limited, that we get enough bang for the buck. Yeah.
Well, there again, this is maybe another show, and it's not like we haven't talked about these sorts of issues with a lot of other people. But I think we're certainly expecting that. We're not expecting the cost of healthcare to go down.
No,
but anything, we're expecting it to go up, and that just makes you wonder: at what point are we going to get to having a more kind of serious discussion about healthcare delivery on a national level? And it seems that now even a lot of doctors are on board with this idea. And maybe in the past, I don't know, maybe doctors have been a problem in the past, but I'm not sure that they're a problem anymore. I think a lot of doctors are just as unhappy about a lot of the ways that healthcare gets delivered as a lot of their patients.
Because we've got 40% of our population, which is 280 million, with no healthcare insurance. And that means that's a lot of people, folks. And that means a lot of these people just aren't getting health care.
Yeah.
Or they're getting piecemeal health care, expensive health care in the emergency departments. And, it's time to do something.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For being here. Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, clinical assistant professor at University of Illinois. Every other month, he's here on a Thursday, and we talk about children's health. Coming up later today on the Afternoon Magazine, on the program, it's designed to try to help you out with particular problems, and this is a show they call Computers and You. They do this once a month. The guest today is Peter Kimball. He's the education program coordinator and lead faculty trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the U of I. And if you've got computer problems, you can give us a call. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon.